This is the TechNet, and this is the 1730th issue, I think, plus or minus 102. You guys already know the TechNet is there to gather the curious radio amateurs who educate each other about wireless products. It is broken into three sections. The question and answer period for the first hour or so, followed by Roy AC2GS. Dr. Roy gives us a science talk. That's followed by Paul WS2N, which gives us the space report with a lot of NASA and other information. The person signs in by giving us your call letters, your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, and yes. And try to remember to wait for the three beeps in between transmissions. So other than Joe, do we have any other people to check in tonight to the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. One more call. Anyone who have any questions or comments for the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now. Eric, KE2EJ, are you available? K2RIW.
Yes, sir. Sounds like you have a call.
That I do. I also noticed that the high frequency notes coming through the repeater are a little bit louder than normal. I like the sound of that. Was there a change in the equalization in the last week or so?
I'd like to say that yes, but actually no. No, I haven't done anything. So I need to do a couple of things in terms of the audio level between the Glen Oaks and Sheldon, but other than that, no.
Right now, when I check the audio level of your last transmission, what comes through 8.5 versus 3.75, they sound almost identical. I think the audio level is right. What makes you think that needs resetting, Eric?
Some folks were complaining. It's been a while since I checked things out at the time anyway.
Okay, that which comes in on 2.5 comes out on 8.5 and 3.75 with equal amplitude. Maybe that which comes in at 9.75 is a little different. I heard another person checking in. Who was that? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
It's NY2H Lou. Yeah, the issue was inputs on 9.75. I'm coming in on 9.75 now, so you can tell if there's a difference or not. It was particularly with one particular station, so I don't know how much of an issue it really is, but maybe you can tell.
Okay, Lou, you're coming in on 9.75. You come out at 8.5 with exactly the right amplitude. You come out of 3.75 a little bit lower. So input on 9.75, output on 3.75 a little bit lower. But at the same time, 9.75 in comes out with the right amplitude on 8.5. So, interesting combination we got there. I wonder if you got that many volume controls, Eric. How in the world can you make the 9.75 audio louder on 3.75 without changing its volume out of 8.5? And the volume coming in on 2.5, leave them alone on both outputs. Do you have enough volume controls to do all that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
I do, but it's kind of a pain. And I can do it all remotely, but still, that's even more of a pain. It's easy to do it while you're there.
Touché. I understand. Go ahead, Wes.
I have a few questions, if you don't mind.
Okay, so you're signing into the TechNet. So far we got Joe and Wes. One last call. Anyone else with questions or comments for the net? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
And to Rio. Comment.
Okay, we got Rich. And one more call. We got Joe, Wes, and Rich. Anyone else with questions or comments for the net? Give me your call letters right now. K2R and name. After the beeps. RIW listening.
Way too. Time is the lunar eclipse.
Hey, you were dropping out, Doug, but we got your message. What time is the lunar eclipse tonight? Does anybody know? I think it's around 11 p.m. local time. Anybody know start and stop time for the lunar eclipse tonight? Teacher Rise, are you listening?
WB2GXM.
GXM, go ahead.
Thank you, Rick. This is Rich. The lunar eclipse starts at approximately 10:30. I do not know what time it is.
That's a very good beginning, Rich. Starting at 10:30, and it's approximately an hour and a half event. So, my guess is at around 11 o'clock or so, or a little bit after 11, is the peak of the event. Anyone else got any further corrections on this? Give me a call that is right now.
At the beginning, middle, and end, it's WS2S.
Go right ahead, Paul. Wait for the beeps.
Actually, the very earliest is 9:36, but that's hard to see anything happening. The total start, they consider it when you start to see a piece of it missing, that's 11:41 p.m. And then the maximum is 12:12, so 12 minutes after the net. And end time is 2:48, the official end time. And each, they give you the degrees, so it's going to be good. It's naturally, if it's clear, we'll see. It starts off around 52 degrees. You go as high as 68 degrees elevation, and then works its way back down to 50 degrees elevation. And the azimuth starts at 112 and goes to 163, 183, and all the way over to the west at 249. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul, for that information. There's one huge difference between a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse. A solar eclipse is when the sun is between, when the moon is between you and the sun. And the very sharp edge of the moon against that bright sun disk is very obvious as to when it first encounters the solar disk, when it's halfway through, and so on. So it's a very sharp edge, very clearly defined beginning and end of the events with a solar eclipse. In the case of a lunar eclipse, you've got this fuzzy edge of the Earth's atmosphere deflecting sunlight through the Earth's atmosphere onto the moon as a partial shadow. So it's a very soft beginning event. You just barely see one end of the moon, a little bit darker than the other side of the moon, as the Earth slowly moves into the position between sun and moon. So therefore you get some very fuzzy numbers as to when is the real beginning and the real end. And when's the middle of the event is not easy to find either. I mean, you're looking at this reddish-colored moon, and you're trying to judge that the reddish color is... Let me drop this. If somebody didn't tell you the times ahead of time, you'd be trying to judge, is the darkness of the moon right now darker or lighter than it was 5 or 10 minutes ago? That's a very difficult judgment to make without using some kind of instrumentation. So from my point of view, a lunar eclipse is not quite as exciting, but it's just a matter of your particular astronomical background. Anybody with any further questions or comments on the lunar eclipse tonight, give me a call, letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, let's see if Doug, you had some dropouts before. Let's see if you're coming through now, and let's see if that's almost all the information you were looking for. WE2SAY in Rocky Point. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much for the information. I appreciate it. Yes, I know what a lunar eclipse is, and I've seen a few of them in my life, and I actually saw a full solar eclipse back was a long, long time ago, back in the 60s. So I appreciate the information. I'll be clear now. WA2SAY here.
Very fine, Doug. You were there 90% of the time that time. Okay, our first guy on our list was Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y. Go right ahead with your information, Joe. T-Q-I-W in the tech net.
Excuse me, before I proceed with that, listen and tell me if you can hear me on the input. And then, if you can't hear me on the input, then listen on 375 and tell me how the audio is coming out of 375. So first, hear me on the, listen to me on the input, which I'm sure you can do, because I'm running 25 watts. We're close enough to, for you to hear me line of sight, I think, fairly easy. And then see how I'm doing that on 375. Have you done that yet? K2RIWWH2RYY.
Yes, Joe, I've done all of the above. Your audio coming out of 85 and your audio coming out of 375 are essentially identical in volume, and they are the correct volume from my point of view. My Yagi is aimed at Glen Oaks, and therefore you in Sayville are off the side of my Yagi at a 90-degree angle. Therefore, I am not hearing you on the input, and I don't want to move the Yagi right now. So I'm not hearing you on the input, but 975, 375, you sound beautiful. Go ahead, Joe.
That's funny, because I can hear you on the input. Okay, now I'm going to switch to 375. Stand by.
I stand by. I forgot to turn my preamp on. Give me another quick transmission. I'll listen for you on the input.
Okay, back on 85. Turn your preamp on. If I can hear you, you should be able to hear me. We're running similar power levels. Here we go, transmitting on 85. You should be able to hear me on the input. I'll copy.
Copying you very well on the input. So go right ahead, Joe.
Alright, now I'm going to just continue listening on 85. We'll switch frequencies to 375. Stand by. Okay, now I'm transmitting on 146.975 coming out of 375. And how do you hear me coming out of 85, number one? And then switch to 375 and tell me how we're coming out of 375. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5-4-3-2-1 1-2-3-4-5 5-4-3-2-1. I'm doing this because I've got a good enough signal that either repeated to not have any noise behind me to put any percentage.
When you transmit a 975, I hear you beautifully on the input, louder than I did on 25. Your signal coming out of 375 and 85 is nice and clear. When you were transmitting on 25, there was a little bit of noise on your signal coming out of 25 and 375, 85 and 375. So when you transmit on 25, you're a little bit noisy. You're 95% signal, 5% noise. When you're on 975, you're dead full quieting. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, well, I can't tell what receiver is at. Yeah, I hear that in the background. I can't tell what receiver is actually picking me up. So I don't know if I'm being picked up by the main receiver or something else. Anyway, I'll proceed with my question now.
If I had my choice, I would tell you to transmit on 975 because you sound so much clearer. Your voice is fuller and there's dead full quieting, whereas when you're on 25, your voice is a little bit squeakier and there's a little bit of noise in the background. Over to you, Joe. Your choice.
And what if I transmit this way? This is another method I have available to me. I am fully duplex this way also. I'll copy on 85.
When you transmit this way, you come out of 85, you do not come out of 375. You sound good on 85, but you're not there on 375. Go ahead.
I know. I can't be in both places at once on this frequency. I won't do that. But anyway, you want to go back? Go back to high band. This is my other radio on UHF. And go back to high band so everybody can hear me.
Roger.
Okay, yeah, I'm copyable enough on 85. I can say this way. My question is actually a pretty simple one. I have a couple of TV converters. I have several of these things now because I've had a couple of crap out from when I originally bought these back in the 2009 time frame with the TV coupons. And I went up to Best Buy and got a couple of Insignia converters. And I've had a couple of crap out along the way. I have three TVs, three converters, one on each. And I've had two crap out already. So I bought a replacement last year. And I just had one recently crap out again. I didn't keep track of if it was my original one. It probably was from when I bought it in 2009. Something apparently happened to the power supply, and they simply won't turn on anymore. When you plug them in the wall, they just simply they won't turn on. They get voltage inside, but they just don't do anything. No blown fuses. Anyway, here's the question. Bought a couple more on eBay. One was supposed to be new in the box, turned out not to be new in the box, but it works. Two that were new in the box have a very strange problem, which I've never encountered before. When you listen to the RF output on channel 3, which is on around 65.75, if you switch the converter from mono to stereo, in mono you're getting full modulating audio from like 30, 45, 60 kilohertz of deviation. I can see that with a service monitor. When I switch to stereo, two converters out of three, it drops down to about maybe 30% of your original volume, like anywhere from between 10, 15 to 25 kilohertz maximum deviation. Any idea what the problem could be?
Yeah, now we're into the intricacies of broadcast. Let's see if Eric heard that question and see if he's got a report on that. KE2EJ, should Joe repeat his question? Keep your eyes up in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I wasn't listening closely, so ask again.
You got it, Joe.
Okay, again, here it goes. In a nutshell, it's basically like this. I bought three more insignia converters. I seem to like them because of the way they operate. One was supposed to be new in the box, ended up not being new in the box, but that one actually works okay. If I monitor the RF carrier output and look at the sound portion of the carrier, when it's dialed up on RF channel 3, I fed it to a splitter so I can see it on the TV, and look at the level on my service monitor at the same time. It's about negative 70, 65, negative 70 coming out of the converter on RF 3. If I have the converter on mono, the audio deviation on 65.75 approximately is about 30 to 45 to 60 kilohertz, depending on the broadcast level audio. It changes very slightly from channel to channel. On two of the converters, if I flip the setting in the converter, which you can do an on-screen setting, to stereo, the audio drops to about maybe anywhere between 15 to 25 kilohertz maximum. So two of them are bad, one is good. The one that's good, there's no change when I flip the stereo to mono. Any idea what's wrong with the other two?
Now, are we talking about an analog converter or an analog device that's putting something out on channel 3?
We're talking about a DTV converter, a digital television converter that takes digital television off the air and runs it into an old 20th century television set, like I own three of them. That's what I'm doing.
And once again, Joe, what is the brand name and model number of the digital television converter you're using? You said it so fast, I don't think any of us got it. Over to you, Joe.
Is the model number that important? I'll get the box right now if you really want to know that.
I gotta say, who cares?
I only want to know the brand name and where did you buy it.
Anyway, Joe, how much deviation
are
you seeing out of the box?
Yeah, Dick, you know, the reason I talk fast is because it seems like I don't get much talk time, and the repeater's timing me out. 90 seconds does not work a lot very well. That's why I talk fast. Sorry about that. The converter is called an Insignia. That's the brand name. Made by LG Electronics. Originally, I bought them in Best Buy. They don't sell anymore. They're not new anymore. Yeah, anything you can find, you have to buy on, like, eBay or some other sales source. So, I bought three of them off of eBay. One of them works okay, doesn't change audio levels. When I'm looking at the RF carrier on channel 3, the audio part of the RF carrier on channel 3 doesn't change at all between going mono to stereo. Two other ones, which are supposed to be new in the box, sealed in the box, and they were, they changed from about 30 to 45 to 60 kilohertz, and it on average down to about maybe 15 to 25. So it drops it like about less than 50% audio.
Okay, you do realize that the maximum deviation for analog television audio is 25 kilohertz and not 75 kilohertz, right?
I'm only telling you what my service monitor monitors on the output of these converters. I don't care what it's supposed to be. I'm telling you what my service monitor actually sees.
Okay, and I'm assuming that your service monitor is set for wideband. Is that correct?
Yes, yes it is. I'm operating an IFR 1500 just like you've probably seen, yes. That has multi-modes. I can definitely operate in wideband. And capture the audio correctly on the scope and on the modulation meter.
Okay, the one thing that is that the service monitor is not going to tell you, really, is that the fact that the stereo audio is what we call BPSV, which is actually a DBX companion encoder, which does funny things. Let's put it this way. If everything was working right and things are according to specs, your sound carrier would be 3 dB down from your video carrier, but in a lot of cases we'll find it 10 dB down from the video carrier, which is sort of irrelevant, but it gives you a clue as to how the box is. And the reality is your peak deviation could just be 25 kilohertz, period. When you switch to stereo, that's when BPSV comes on. The pilot just at the horizontal frequency, double the horizontal frequency, and there's some other things that are going on. So it could be the BPSV chip in the boxes themselves. There could be some other issues that are going on that you find that there's a difference in level between being in mono and being in stereo.
Well, one decoder box doesn't change level at all. And it is, I am in the right setting because the highest deviation the service monitor will display is 60 kilohertz. And I do see the peak audio going up as high as almost 60 kilohertz. That's the volume set to 100% on the converter because it is controllable. And if you turn that volume level down, up or down, you can actually change the deviation output on the RF carrier. But I'm running it at 100% just for test purposes. So one box doesn't change when I change the setting from mono to stereo, but two other converters, it drops down to less than 50%.
Okay. Without the right, how can I say this? Really, the filter that you should be using for the service monitor is not available. It should be 25 kilohertz rather than 50, as in 75. But the other thing is that if you hear no difference in level between mono and stereo, it sounds like the BPSV circuit's not popping in because it's actually should be a 3 dB reduction in total output.
Okay, well, the other converters I have on the TVs that I haven't replaced so far, they'll do the same thing. You switch from mono to stereo, there's no difference on the... I didn't check those in the service wire, but there's no... observable, audible difference your ear could detect when you go from mono to stereo. I can't hear a difference. So those converters are operating like the one I bought off eBay, the new replacement, went to where apparently been. I was just curious if just somebody happened to know what was possibly wrong with these things, especially if something that was supposed to be new in the box, and they were new, two of them were new in the box.
Eric, you talked about the BTSC circuit. What does that stand for, and what is that circuit doing?
You're familiar with Dolby, correct? Well, BTSC, instead of using Dolby's method of frequency division and companding, they use a company called DBX, which is also used in the recording industry, which is different, somewhat different than Dolby. It accentuates more the high frequencies, where the band is split up at different places, and the equalization in the end is a whole lot different than what Dolby does. It's sort of the difference between Dolby A, Dolby B, and Dolby C, which is the consumer version. DBX is more like Dolby B, which is the pro version.
So, these identical brand name digital television converters, do you believe a defect has happened in one, or different alignment procedure. And a guess as what could be creating the difference that Joe is seeing, Eric? Over to you, Eric.
No, my guess would be, and I've seen this in some other devices, the version of converter that he's talking about is very common, and there was, I think, I fixed 8 revisions over the life of it. The earlier ones did not look at the precepts and get its information as to what stereo and what mono and so on and so forth, whereas the later version would look at the signal being generated. It'll see that there's a stereo flag which would switch the BTSC step on and off. As much as some of the later ones also did AFC, which is the automatic format descriptor, and it would actually change from letterbox to wide and various different formats depending upon what the incoming signal was. So depending upon what the serial number of the box is, there's going to be differences of them, you know, over the period of time that they manufactured them.
I'm curious as to why the digital television converter has a selectable item of mono versus stereo. If you had a very old-fashioned television set that had nothing but mono, and the digital converter put out stereo, are they not compatible? Would it not work? Must you have mono in that case in order to hear audio correct properly? Over to you, Eric.
Now, if you had a TV set that was mono only, and it's got the filter that's 4.5 megahertz to keep the video out, and it's not very narrow, as the digital signal that's being converted goes between mono and stereo, we're really talking about the output of the box, which is making the analog. On a older type of mono receiver, you'll hear an increase in noise. The actual high-frequency noises and the hisses will increase in the stereo mode.
Understand. You got it, Jim.
I have no other questions on the subject. Apparently, it was something that's of a later manufacturing date, and they are what they are. I'm going to return them anyway. I already contacted 2 people, and hopefully I can buy other ones that maybe are of an older vintage that won't do this for me.
For the people who are into digital television DXing like you are, Joe, I know there's not very many of them. You're a rare breed. You're buying these from, I think, an eBay-like, I said eBay. You know what I mean. One of these online places. And roughly how many dollars are the cost of these things?
New in the box, I got the ranging from about $22 to $29, not including shipping. That's fairly cheap. That's a lot cheaper. I think they were originally like about $60 with the DTV coupons from like 2009. So they're about, half the price, third of the price, something like that. But there's plenty of them out there. I think SAM up in Connecticut bought one on eBay. I don't know if he got a new one in the box or what he got, but we talked about this a couple of months ago, and he went on eBay and he found one also. I guess he's pretty happy with it.
When it comes to buying digital converters, how many other places could you go to other than eBay? I would guess Amazon, maybe not, but I'll bet you there's a couple of other websites that sell satellite television receiving equipment that might also cover these. Over to you, Joe.
To be to YY. Well, I didn't try other places, like putting in like a for sale on Google with the converter. It was an NXDX. You really want the model number, don't you? You want me to go read you the model number off the box? You seem like you're very curious on this, so then you'll know.
Nope, not looking for the model number. Only wanted the brand name, and you've supplied that. Back to you for any other comments, Joe.
I have a question.
You got it, Eric.
I'm assuming that once you tune in a DX station, you're recording it on something. What are you recording it on? How are you recording it?
All my recording devices, since they can't really reliably record off the air, they won't record subchannels off the air reliably. They do funny things. I use a Magnavox, one of these DVD tape combo units, and I have just simply the converter The converter goes to a splitter. One leg goes to the TV side. One leg goes to the Magnavox, the unit. It's, I think it's a MZ457 or something like that. It's model 457. I'm looking at it right now. I got the lights over. I can't see. But I have three or four of those. And when I want to record a program, I can just set that up, set up the time, and have it look at the output of the converter on channel 3. And so forth. That's how I originally picked up one of them. I picked up this problem because when I played back the recorded program, it says, "Hey, that sounds a little. It sounds a little low." When I'm playing on another machine in another room, and I went back to the TV that I recorded this from that location. And sure enough, the TV sound level is also low. Also, that's when I checked the other one I bought off of eBay, and that one did the same thing. So, you know. Don't know. There's no adjustments inside this. You can't turn any coils. There's nothing to adjust. No pops. No nothing. So there's nothing I can do with these things.
Now, I'm going to overly simplify Joe's question, I mean Eric's question. You are recording this on something like a video cassette recorder, Joe?
No. I'm recording these on DVD discs that are erasable. I'll record them, and I bought like 90 discs when I went, last time I went to Staples, just I had plenty. Before I record all the TV scenes. I can reuse these things. I don't record them on tape anymore. I used to do that. I got much better quality recording it directly to a DVD, burning it to a DVD and disc and playing it back later on.
The reason for my question is, please take the analog output of the converter that he's using, and using that into his DVD recorder, because it's taking the analog input and chopping it up again, making little bits for the DVD. The reason why I ask is because I don't do that. That's kind of silly. There are quite a number of devices out there that take the ATSC stream, and you can record the whole stream, and then you can actually later take and place DVDs and stuff like that out of it. And because you recorded the whole stream, if there were sub-channels, you get all the sub-channels for this, but if you're not a computer-centric person, then don't even think about it. Pick RIWK, do it again.
The converter he's using is spitting out an analog signal on roughly channel 3 frequency, and it has remodulated the video it has detected, remodulated the audio, and so on. And then, in theory, you can take the channel 3 composite RF signal and demodulate it again in order to record it by some procedure. Is there a way, or maybe you're already doing it, Joe, where you take the internal to the
video out,
you take the video and audio before it has been remodulated on the channel 3? Is that what you're about to say, Eric?
Let me just put my two cents in. I tried doing that on one unit, and it found for some reason the recorder unit didn't like what it heard. It sure heard like a background AC hum on either one or both of the stereo of the channels, either left or right, and I didn't like what I heard. It was just very low, subtle in the background, so I didn't like that, and I just didn't use that method anymore. So I decided to record directly off the analog output, and it works fine to me.
Analog RF output. Okay, and I guess the analog up converting from audio and video onto a channel 3 RF signal, I guess the fidelity of that is good enough not to worry about it. Over to you, Eric, for any further comments. KE2EJ, K2IW.
No, I didn't quite catch what you said there. It is taking and going into the RF input of the DVD recorder that he has, which is kind of unusual, unless it's a tape to DVD recorder, which you can then stick RF into it. Or it's using a three cable, you know, a video out and audio left and audio right. I wasn't sure which one he got. But either way, it'll work.
If I understand correctly, he's using the first because he gets some funny hum on the audio left or right when he uses the three cable technique. Is that correct, Joe?
That is correct.
Probably a ground loop, the gear that he's using. Don't forget the decoder is a digital device. It makes clocks, and they don't really take a lot of care of isolating from the output, so whatever works, that's all you need.
Okay, I think we've answered your questions for tonight. Is that correct, Joe? And will we see you next week?
If I come up with a question, perhaps.
And when did you not come up with a question? Next person on the list was Wes, in 2XJM. Go right ahead, Wes, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2XJM. Phase and polarization are not only not the same things, but have nothing to do with each other of electromagnetic waves. But I was recently asked a question, and I thought that this youngster who is listening right now could listen to your explanation. And to exchange.
Okay, you've got a question about over-the-air broadcast or something like that, and you've got somebody standing by, you're listening to my explanation. Go right ahead with your question. N2XJN, K2RIW, waiting for your question now. Or should we wait for your friend to say something?
Okay, can you hear me now?
I'm hearing you now.
Sorry. Okay, so the question was, what's the difference between phase and polarization of electromagnetic waves? And I explained to him, but I thought you would do it better. And to Ishii.
Okay, that's the question. The difference between phase, about RF wave, and polarization. Okay. I'll discuss polarization first. If I was transmitting with a horizontally polarized dipole, at the dipole where the wire is parallel to the ground, E field is horizontal, the H field, the magnetic field coming out of that antenna is vertical. The two have to be at right angles to each other in order to propagate through space correctly. And let me think about that. I think they got to be 90 degrees out of phase. Well, that we won't get into that one. But the polarization of the magnetic field and the polarization of the electric field are at right angles to each other, and a horizontally polarized signal would come out of that horizontal antenna. If I took that dipole and now rotated it so that it is perpendicular to the ground, the signal that transmitted would be vertically polarized, and the magnetic field would be horizontally polarized. You would reverse the two, so to speak. And in order to get proper reception, the antenna that's picking up the signal should be equal in polarization. Assuming you've got one simple path between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, if you were foolish enough to transmit with a horizontally polarized antenna and listen with a vertically polarized antenna, you would get an extremely weak signal and maybe nothing at all. That polarization is quite sensitive. It follows the trigonometric cosine law. Let me drop. In other words, if I was measuring the magnitude of the voltage I pick up at the receiving antenna, as they rotate the polarization of one antenna versus the other, there is a proper angle between the two. Horizontal and horizontal will give you the best signal. Horizontal and vertical, of, you know, cross-polarized, will give you the weakest signal. As I slowly rotate the polarization difference, the angle difference, it follows the cosine theta law. Cosine of 0 degrees is 1. So in other words, if the 0 degrees of angular error between transmitting antenna and receiving antenna, I would get full amplitude. The cosine theta law is telling me the voltage magnitude. If I rotate 45 degrees, cosine of 45 degrees is 0.707. The voltage would be down to 0.707. And since power is a function of voltage squared, I'd be getting half power. And that sort of makes sense, too, because if I rotate the antenna 45 degrees from the proper orientation, which was horizontal, you could say half of my signal amplitude is horizontal and half of it is vertical. That's an oversimplification, but it gives you a little bit of an idea. So as you can tell, that's for a simple transmitting path between transmitting antenna and receiving antenna with no multipath. Let me drop. One of the things that's very hard for any of us to learn in the process of having radio signals explained to us, antennas transmitting signals, is the problem of multipath. A transmitting antenna, if you could see the full three-dimensional antenna pattern of that antenna in space, it would look like a donut. A donut with the wire going through the hole of the donut, and the stronger signal is broadside to the wire. That's where the donut is fattest. And off the ends of the wire is where the signal goes to minimum. So you have a donut-shaped antenna pattern. But that donut-shaped antenna pattern is transmitting signals in a zillion different angles. Every square degree on that donut pattern, there's a signal going out there in that direction. So for the most part, the signal is transmitting everywhere. And that signal transmitting everywhere strikes every single object in your environment. Let me drop. You've got that horizontally polarized dipole on the top of your tower. Let's assume that it's a 30-foot tower in your backyard. And you've got that horizontal dipole on the top of the tower. And you're talking to your buddy who's also got a dipole on the top of a 30-foot tower, and he's 10 miles away. And you'd like to believe that with the line of sight between those two towers and the two dipoles, the signal simply flows from one to the other. That's not even 1% of what's going on. An awful lot of that signal is striking the ground, striking all the trees, striking all the buildings, striking the water towers, other buildings, and whatever. That signal coming out of the transmitting antenna is striking every single thing in the environment, even things that you cannot see. The signal is penetrating the trees to some degree and reflecting off a deeper tree, if you know what I mean, even though your eye cannot see it. The signal gets to the receiving antenna is a mixture of every one of those tiny reflecting signals. They're all being added together in a vector manner. And the vector manner in this case is got two meanings. Vector meaning after reflection, the polarization may be different. After reflection, the time delay is going to be different. Therefore, there's going to be a phase shift. We haven't discussed phase shift yet. So you add up all of those signals coming to the receiving antenna, and that's what you're going to get. That gives you a little bit of an idea of why when you take your handy talkie and listening to a weak signal in your living room, we'll say, and you rotate the handy talkie in the X plane, the Y plane, or the Z plane, or you translate it in the X plane or Y plane or Z plane, you'll hear the signal going up and down in amplitude. Let me drop. Because there are times when only a small fraction of a wavelength of motion of your handy talkie makes all of those signals being added together add up a little bit more favorably or a little bit less favorably. And so the signal goes up and down on what you receive. So whenever you're getting a poor reception on a handy talkie, don't just give up and say, hey, you're not strong enough. Try moving that handy talkie. Go to different rooms. Hold it at different altitudes, sometimes even lower. My handy talkie gives me best reception of this repeater when my handy talkie is horizontally polarized, laying on a plastic shelf in my bathroom. How in the world did that vertically polarized signal out of this repeater become horizontally polarized? That's a complicated issue, but take my word for it. With all of those bounces going on, the polarization gets randomized. Now, that's polarization of a signal. And so far we've discussed horizontal and vertical polarization. There is also something called circular polarization, clockwise circular and counterclockwise circular. We won't go there right now. It's already complicated enough. Let me drop. Now, of those multipath signals that I've been discussing coming out of your transmitting antenna, one of those signals goes directly from transmitting antenna to receiving antenna. That's the one that arrives first. If you wanted to, you could use it as the reference signal. And now, by some means, you do a careful analysis and you find out that one of the signals coming out of the transmitting antenna is bouncing off of a water tower and then coming to your receiving antenna. The bounce off the water tower, by definition, is a longer path. The longer path means that that signal arrives at the receiving antenna delayed in time. You can measure the delay in time in microseconds, or you can measure it in phase angle. The choice is yours. If it was a quarter of a wavelength of delay, we would call that a 90 degree delay in time, and you could call it a 90 degree delay in phase. The RF wave arriving by the second path bouncing off the water tower is on a dual trace oscilloscope. On a dual trace oscilloscope, you'd see that second signal 90 degrees delayed in time. The sine wave would be shifted over to the left on that dual trace oscilloscope. So that's a phase shift, which really is a kind of time delay. It turns out that many circuits, particularly filters, will create electronic delay in time or delay in phase. A signal flowing through a bandpass filter gets delayed in time. The signal flowing through a low-pass filter doesn't get through there instantaneously. Even though the physical dimensions of your low-pass filter may be 1 inch long, which is only a tenth of a nanosecond at the speed of light, 1 inch in free space, the signal flowing through that low-pass filter, that bandpass filter, could easily be delayed 90 degrees, which is a quarter of a wavelength, a hell of a lot more delay. So electronic filters create phase delay. Not an easy concept to accept, but don't take my word for it. There's a lot more to either of these subjects. We've just scratched the surface a little bit, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you for that. You have no receiver, you have only transmitter. Can you talk about the existence of phase delay, N2XJN?
Okay, I missed some words. Are you saying you now want me to go through the same analysis, assuming there is no multipath? Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
I want you to go to the same analysis, knowing that there is no receiver, and talking about the phase delay, and to experience.
Phase delay and time delay really are the identical thing, just different ways of measuring it. When you're measuring a time delay or a phase delay, you have to use something as a reference. This is the signal I get when I use antenna number one, and this is the signal I get when I use antenna number two, and the signal that's arriving at antenna number two is a quarter wavelength delayed, or 90 degrees delayed in phase. There has to be a reference. Without a receiver, what are you going to use as a reference? The signal coming out of the transmitter is going into all directions in space. If I measure the signal a mile away, I'll get a certain amount of delay of that signal. If I measure the signal 2 miles away from the transmitting antenna, I'm going to get, of course, a greater delay. The signal is going through space at roughly the speed of light. So all possible phase angle and all possible delays exist around that antenna that's doing the transmitting. They only become defined when you stick some kind of a probe out there, like a receiving antenna, into a receiver, and you make a measurement. Phase delay and time delay has to be with reference to something. Without a reference, it has no meaning. Over to US, K2RIW.
Absolutely agree with that. Tesla coil is velocity inhibited slow wave cuticle transmission line resonator. So by that we have two coils. And Tesla coil has a load on it, which is a capacitor on the top. Then, due to existence of the sending wave, we have a time delay, which at that coil we have a existence of the slow wave, and that would be our phase difference to the phase of the signal that was sent into it from the primary coil and transmission.
All right, you've given me some information, but I haven't heard you ask a question yet.
I have two questions. First question, We're dealing with the standing wave in the antenna, which would be the Tesla coil, the high voltage Tesla coil, which is made out of two coils. The low voltage where the generator is connected to or the transmitter, and the high voltage, which is connected one side to the ground and the other side to the load capacitor on the top of it. So when we're dealing with the standing wave, it bounces back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Then can we talk about phase delay and trick shear?
Almost all Tesla coils are not fed with a sine wave signal generator. The raw signal does start off as a sine wave, but it goes into some kind of a spark gap device that is transmitting impulses into the primary coil, which creates a impulse into the secondary coil. The secondary coil does have a resonance, and the signal becomes somewhat a damped sine wave. After each individual impulse going into the primary coil, the secondary coil responds with a damped sine wave. So in the case of an impulse, you don't necessarily have a clearly defined phase, place of measurement. So the Tesla coil is not being fed with a pure sine wave. Yes, because of the resonance and because of the signal bouncing back and forth on the secondary coil with the capacitor at the top and the ground at the bottom, it is sinusoidal light, but it's a damped sine wave after each individual impulse. In some cases, you're putting 120 pulses per second into it with certain methods of feeding it. So the word phase delay doesn't have a clear meaning here. What's your reference point? Do you mean you could put some kind of a receiving antenna 10 feet away from your Tesla coil? Let me drop. You could put some kind of a receiving antenna 10 feet away, looking at the signal being transmitted by your Tesla coil, a very complicated signal. You'd have to look at it on an oscilloscope. And then you could make some kind of a change. Add a little piece of metal to the capacitor at the top, which increases its capacitance, which lowers the resonant frequency, which will create the exact same damped sine wave, but a little bit more delayed. So you have a difficult definition of what's the reference phase in order for you to discuss a phase delay. Over to you, CKQLAW.
Thank you for that. Tesla coil has more in common with character resonator than it does with conventional inductor. That's the quote from Corum. Corum Brothers, the one who started 2 years from now, going to change the world because they do what Tesla wanted to do. They have about over 100 patents right now, and they're trying to send electricity around the earth without the wires. Let me drop.
Now, that's an impossible transmission. That's an impossible goal. And there's some basic laws of physics telling you that there's a 0.0% chance of that being working. By the way, a Tesla coil is the modern-day equivalent of an old-fashioned spark gap transmitter that used to be popular in, say, 1910 WS.
With all due respect, Dick, you are the teacher of many, teacher of mine. I disagree. Well, I have a problem with that. That would be more kind. What it does is let me drop. You have a primer of Tesla coil, and you connect a generator, and it will be sine wave generator. On the secondary of Tesla coil, you put the capacitor on the top of the coil, and there is a difference in height between the end of the top of the coil and that capacitor. That capacitor is actually giving you a right polarization. There is something that is being known as surface wave. And that particular kind of surface wave is the Zenek wave. What is happening is, when you have that, let me drop. When you have that capacitor high enough that is not influenced by being close to the earth, and you pump a few thousand volts into it, you're creating a sort of polarization of that wave, and is at a certain angle to the ground, and let's say it's more common 62 degrees. Now, when it hits at 62 degrees, the ground, it creates a mirror image deep in the ground of the same wave. Now, the crossing vectors of that wave is the reflection, imaginary reflection of it, and that wave is coming to the ground, let me drop it, is giving you the traveling wave, and that particular traveling wave is that Zenek wave. Now, the initial investment right now is of $500 million structure in Texas, and over $3 billion for yesterday. Now, they said that 30 days from now, which would be 24 days left, they're going to launch the first delivery of electricity. And about end of the year, they're going to make the first test of delivering electricity to the next continent. Now, with all of those representatives they have army generals, they have big oil companies involved and being in the staff of that company. Chevron is one of the companies that is involved, and the former CEO of Chevron now is one of the guys in a company called VZIP, and the other one of the same guys is Texan. I don't believe that somebody would put so much money, and also there is a DARPA program created especially to test military application of Zenek wave, and plenty of government in interested in it. I don't believe that this is a hoax, but I take your word. And to Asia.
I didn't say it's a hoax. Every phenomenon with reference to radio that you observe, there's almost always three, four, or five ways of explaining it. Choose the right way of explaining it, and you can convince somebody that the two and two is five. The diagram you described to me of the Zenek wave, I think you pronounced it, above the ground and the mirror image below the ground, gives you a diagram, gives you a mental image. Let me drop it.
Forgot to tell you that this is being done by taking one of the TM modes and using only a transverse magnetic mode to launch that. So there is no radiation. And this is kind of, let me drop it.
Will this transmitting antenna have the ability of transmitting signals in every direction around the compass, north, south, east, and west? If the answer is yes, then it's an omnidirectional antenna, or almost an isotropic antenna. The desired receiving antenna is only a very small angle of all of those 41,253 degrees, 1 degree squares on the sphere. Your desired path direction is an extremely small fraction of all the directions you're sending signal into. From that point of view, conservation of energy, it is very unlikely to be successful at any reasonable range, like 100 miles, or you said another continent. Even though the method of explanation convinced people that this is a viable approach and they put lots of money and enthusiasm into it, that doesn't mean it's going to work. When they do this experiment, I think it's at 27 days from now.
Repeater, time out.
When they do that experiment 27 days from now, how soon after they first turn it on will they tell us yes or no it doesn't work over the U.S.? Because it's going to be interesting to test, to come back in 4 weeks and ask you this exact same question. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Before I answer this question, there is something that you didn't understand yet. The space between Earth and the air is being called interface. And when you have two different lossy media, then the magnetic component of electromagnetic wave actually for all T